Today's case show will be on case 46 in the Book of Serenity, Dishan's Completion of Study. Introduction. The clear ground, where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, deludes people. The clear sky without a fleck of cloud in the eight directions fools you. Even though this is using a wedge to remove a wedge, it doesn't prevent taking space and hanging it in space. A single mallet on the back of the brain, particularly, observe the appropriate technique. Case. Great Master Yuan Ming of Dishan said to the assembly, "When you get to the ultimate end, you will find the Buddhas of all times have their mouths hung on the wall. There is still someone who laughs, ha ha. If you know this one, your task of study is finished." Verse. Gathering in, holding closed the throat, wind polishes, clouds wipe. The waters are cold, the weather is autumn. Don't say brocade-colored fish lack rich taste. Fishing through the ocean waves, one hook of moon. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning on this beautiful autumn morning to practice Zazen, to practice Chan. Some of you are here for the first time. A few of you are here for the first time to hear this Taisho. And perhaps you were a little baffled by it. Generally, the English language, when it's written down and published, makes some degree of sense. So this might have been a little bit confusing. Gathering in, holding close the throat, wind polishes, clouds wipe, huh? The waters are chill, the weather is autumn, don't say brocade-colored fish lack in rich taste, fishing through the ocean waves, one hook of moon, huh? So part of this could be just that Thomas Cleary isn't very good at translating Chinese. Actually, people think he's pretty good. So maybe it's not a problem with translation, and in fact, it's not. The language of koans is not always ordinary language. It's not always ordinary language. This is also true for the sutras we recite. If you came here this morning and you were expecting just a lecture, you might have been a little surprised that we were reciting these sutras. And these sutras are strange in their own way because they're not really Japanese. It's possible, if you don't know Japanese, to think that these are Japanese texts. But actually, most Japanese people who heard these sutras would be utterly baffled as to what they meant. Because they're really Japanese phonetic approximations of Chinese sutras, which were also phonetic approximations of Sanskrit. So they tried to duplicate the sound of Sanskrit words in Chinese, and then they sent these sutras over to Japan, and the Japanese tried to make them fit the sounds of Chinese, Japanese words. So this is really almost insane, right? Why would anybody do this when you could just put the sutras in English and understand their meaning? And why is it that the author of this particular koan, this particular story, just didn't tell us in plain words what it's all about? Well, there's different levels of understanding. You know, there's a kind of understanding which is based upon commonplace assumptions. So if I see you on the street and I say, "How are you?" you're supposed to say, "Oh, I'm good, thanks," right? Or you're supposed to say, "Oh, okay." Generally speaking, you would be surprised if somebody said, "How are you?" And a person turned and, or if you said to somebody, "How are you?" and they turned and said, "The dog is in the broth." Do you know, the dog could be in the broth. There's a deeper way of understanding things. Sometimes we come close to that, or we begin to enter that deeper way of understanding through, say, art. So if you are a fan of poetry, you may have read poems that on first reading really don't make much sense, you know. You might read a couple lines of poetry and be really baffled. Say, "What is this about? What is this all about?" And this can happen also if you like painting. So you could go to the museum and you could see a painting by somebody like Marc Chagall. And there are goats upside down floating around in the sky. And they're not white goats, they're green goats. And there's a guy playing a fiddle, but he's also upside down. And the clouds are underneath him, his feet, or something like that. This is a world of art. We understand that it's different from the ordinary world. We might not exactly understand how it's different, but we know it's supposed to be different. You know, originally, art can sort of be an empty game. It can just be a snobbish game that people play. Mm-hmm. Or it can be a commodity in a marketplace. So, for example, Marc Chagall paintings are worth a lot of money. And there's all kinds of misunderstandings about art. But one way to think about what art does is that it lets us experience the world in a way that's a little less ordinary, a little less regimented or controlled. So normally, as we grow up, we begin to be able to predict how things are going to happen pretty accurately. And we learn what to look, even when we see, we learn what to look for and what not to look for. You learn that this is important and this isn't important. By the time you're, say, 25 years old, your world could already have gotten very stale. You know, you pretty much are in a routine that's set for you for life, and the way you experience the moment might be very routinized also. So art can be exciting for people because it sort of takes them out of the ordinary way of experiencing things, ordinary way of thinking, ordinary way of seeing, and it lets them imagine the world in a different way. And this is very liberating because it's reaching down to a deeper level, deeper level of our consciousness. And when we're looking at a painting like a Marc Chagall painting, or we're listening to a poem that we like because it's strange and it's a little bit hard to understand, we may begin to have this sense of like things are coming alive. Things are coming alive. And this is it's hard to describe, but this feeling that it's like you're at a doorway. And you're in front of a closed door, and you're excited about what might be on the other side of the door, in the other room. And there's that moment where it's thrilling, right? It's just thrilling. You could open that door, and anything could be in there. You know, could be the Grand Canyon, you know, could be a delicious meal, could be. Whatever, you know, you just never know. It could be a tiger, you know. This is slightly thrilling. this way of experiencing the world, right? It's slightly thrilling. And this is why art is exciting, for at least for some people. You know, because you can go to the museum and you can look at a picture, and it might be describing a world you've never seen. And in its strangeness, it may be, you get that feeling you would get at the door, about to open a door and thinking, what is going to be on the other side of this door? It's like, you could say wonder or enchantment. You know, some people get this feeling from the natural world too. You know, you go hiking out in the woods and you might find something you've never seen before, or experience something you've never experienced before. When I was about 20 years old, when I 21, I guess 22, I finished college, and one of my goals in life was to go backpacking out in the Southwest. And I went out to a place called it was called Canyonlands National Park in Utah. And it was the most amazing experience, because I had never been to Utah, and I had never seen anything like that place. You know, the mountains were, they had mountains of stone with no trees on them. They're just ancient stone, red stone hills, I guess you could say. And they were carved by wind and rain into these incredible shapes, so that they looked like Hindu temples. And so there was like a whole mountain range as far as the eye could see of these red stone hills. And in the valleys there was incredibly rich grass and trees, cottonwood trees. So it was like, just like bright green. So deep red hills, bright green valleys. This was like something out of a dream. It was so extraordinary, and it was so wonderful. And when I first got there, I was so excited. I was like a little kid again. And it was just so exciting, because I realized that life was bigger than I thought. It didn't affect me on a conscious level. You know, I had already seen pictures of the Southwest. You know, really, that's in books. I'd seen westerns, you know, the cowboy movies. But when I got there, it was on a deeper level. It just made my whole body sort of light up with energy, you know. And some people have this same kind of experience when they read poetry, believe it or not. Maybe if poetry isn't your thing, it might not do it for you. But if you love poetry, sometimes you can just start reading a poem, and at first you think, where the hell is this going? And then all of a sudden you get that feeling like you're about to open a strange door, and you just light up with life. Some people get it from music. You know. I was just listening to something the other day on the radio by a composer whose name is Vaughan Williams. He's a composer I'm not very familiar with. But I had maybe heard one thing by him in my whole life. And I was driving up to northern New Jersey. We have a sit on Sunday morning. We have meditation there on Sunday morning. And I found this classical station, and I turned it on, and this composer's name is Ralph Vaughan Williams. And the music was so gripping. I'd never heard it before. It was unlike anything I'd ever heard before, and it was so gripping. You know, I was just thinking, I have got to listen to more of this guy's stuff. This is so interesting and so exciting. I had that feeling like I'm standing at a door, and I'm going to open the door, and I don't know what's on the other side. It's like wonder or enchantment, right? It's somehow you come to life. So this experience of coming to life, of being filled with like life energy, wonder, enchantment, is really central to what we talk about when we talk about Zen. So this is Zen is really like an art of wonder, or an art of enchantment. Only we don't use notes, you know, like musical notes, and we don't use words, and we don't use colors, although, you know, those are really wonderful. We use a seated meditation. That's our, you could say, our medium is actually the human body and human consciousness. That's where we work in the body-mind awareness. That's our medium. Right? So painters have paints, composers have their instruments, and writers have words, poets have words, and we Zen people have a consciousness. That's our medium, body-mind consciousness. And it's often the case that that experience of wonder or enchantment doesn't come easily for people. It's just the case, you know. You can read 20 poems, and in poem after poem, you know, it just seems like work. You pick up this poem and you think, all right, well, let's see what happens. And you read it through and you might say, oh, that's very well done. Or you might say, that's interesting, but, you know, at the end of the experience, not much has changed. That if you're waiting for your body to come to life, it just doesn't happen that day. You know, maybe 20 poems like that. Maybe 50. And then you find something, and it's just like, boom. You know, this is really amazing. You know. Same thing with the visual. You know, you can go to the museum and look at painting after painting. And you just say, well, that's pretty, that's nice, ooh, that's interesting, my, he's a good painter, she's a good, you know, very interesting. Then you hit one and it's just like, boom. The other day I got a promotional copy of the new Norton Anthology of American Literature. And it was just a brochure for the new edition of this anthology. But the cover art on the book was so extraordinary. It was the most beautiful painting I've seen in years. I can't describe it to you, but it was I can't do justice to it, but it was a painting of an autumn field, and there was a tree in the foreground, and it had ripe, overripe fruits, you know, clinging to the tree, and almost all the leaves were off the tree. And in the distance, you could see that the trees were turning color, you know, as autumn came on, and that these ripe fruits were kind of shriveling. They were small, you could see they were kind of shriveling, they were hanging on, but they were bright red. And I can't do justice to it, but it literally, like, knocked my socks off. I just thought, and I called the Norton Company, and nobody could tell me, or would tell me, who was the artist? You know, they actually said, well, you should buy the book. It's probably inside the book, you know. Really, that's what they said. I thought, oh, come on, have mercy, you know. Tell me now. But they pretended that either they didn't know or they didn't want to tell me. I don't know. But I'm going to get that book, or I'm going to go find it in the bookstore and open it up and find out who that artist is anyway. Because it was just so great. I have a painting in my house, which I actually bought for my wife, and I got it for a present for our 25th anniversary. It's actually not a painting; print by a woman whose name is Karen Silverwood. She's an artist whose work I really like. And it's a road in the Southwest. It's set in New Mexico, probably, or Arizona. And it's a road that is going along a path, going along a riverbed. And along the riverbed, there are these sage plants, these beautiful sage plants. So it's like a path in this green field. And in the distance are mountains, which are sort of purple-gray. And there's storm clouds coming up. But it's a sort of like dry desert, like New Mexico, or like in parts of India. And I look at that, every time I look at that, I think, where does that road go? You know, where does that road go? And I love that painting. I don't think my wife loves it as much as I do, you know. Sometimes it's in our bedroom and it's across from our bed, and I'll look at that and say, boy, that is a great painting, isn't it, you know. Barbara said, yes, it's a very nice painting, you know. So I kind of gave the painting to me, I guess, for our 25th anniversary. I didn't mean to, but you know, it doesn't, you know, different people have different, different things do it for different people, you know. So I meant to open the door for her, but maybe that's just not her door. I think she likes it, or it wouldn't be on our wall. But I don't think it, you know, I go to bed at night and look at that and think, oh, where does that road go? You know, where does that road go? And she has things like that excite her. She has a beautiful reproduction of a Chinese painting of a dog in her study, where she sometimes does painting. And it's a great picture. The dog's head is turned up. I guess it was done in the Ming Dynasty. But she loves that painting, and it is indeed beautiful. But I think for her, that's the door. That's the magic door. You know. So, anyway, usually these things that open a door for us, like poetry, or painting, or music, see, somehow they interrupt the normal routine. Right? They interrupt it. And they make it possible for us, even if just momentarily, right, to experience the world a little differently, a little differently. Maybe that effect wears off after a while, but for a little while, it's just amazing, right? It's just absolutely amazing. A friend of mine who's much younger than I was telling me what it was like to see. I think he was about 13 when, maybe he was younger than that, like 12, when the first Star Wars movie came out. And I was probably 22, 23, something like that, when that came out. And I saw the movie and I was impressed. But this person I know who works at the university, he was probably 12 when that. And he said at one time, he was talking about that movie, and he said it changed his life, right? He said he went into the theater, he saw that movie, and he came out like a different person. Yeah. And I can believe that. You know, that's what good art does, good art does. It's like changes the way we experience the world, maybe just momentarily. So usually it does this by breaking up our routines, our mental routines, our personal routines, our conceptual routines, and letting us experience things a little differently. See? And that's sort of the idea of the koan, too. So this is why these are not words that necessarily make sense first time around. If you think about it, these are speaking to a deeper part of yourself, deeper part of yourself. There's a part of yourself which is a conscious mind. This is the mind that works in familiar terrain, right? The conscious mind works with ideas that are words that are familiar, ideas that are familiar, ways of thinking and acting that are familiar. You know, the conscious mind says, is a planning mind, is the mind that assesses, that compares, and so on. This is like conscious mind. But I don't think this is the mind that comes to life, see, that experiences wonder and enchantment. There's a deeper mind. See, and Zen practice is all about tapping into that deeper mind, that deeper mind. If you want to think about people who do Zen, you could say that they are like, Zen practice is learning how to be closely in touch with that deeper mind. You could call it your unconscious mind if you wanted to. You know, the language of the sutras and the language of the koans, like the little story I just read, or the little text I just read, This is like an unconscious language, very much like poetry, right? Music too. Music is really not trying to impress your conscious mind. In fact, you know, music really has no intellectual content. You know, there are people who study music theory who are interested in how compositions are arranged and so on. But music goes right to the deeper part of yourself. It just doesn't even bother to go through language, right? Just right into a deeper kind of a unconscious experience, direct experience of the world. And sometimes a painting does that too, just the sheer visual impact. Well, you know, as I was saying a little earlier, Zen is also about opening this door and the experience of wonder or enchantment, right? And Zen is a little different form, but it's also kind of, I think it's helpful to understand Zen as a kind of art. It's a kind of art of consciousness. See, and if you understand this way, Zen this way, I think you will be getting off on a good footing, good start, if you decide to walk the road of Zen. It's possible to understand Zen in a very different way. I mean, people sometimes understand Zen as a quest for enlightenment, right? And in fact, if you read books on Buddhism, often enlightenment is made to be very important. And even I, myself, emphasize the importance of Kensho quite often on occasions like this one, in the Teisho. I'll talk about Kensho, Dai Kensho, Little Kensho, Big Kensho. We're talking about becoming Buddhas. We're talking about achieving awakening and so on. And all of this is true. This is true. But if you understand Zen practice this way, I think it can create some tensions and some problems for you. Because it's possible to practice on the cushion with this these payoffs in mind, right? So, you know, some people who come to Zen for the first time have really good sits, and sometimes after maybe a couple weeks they have a really good sit. And they sit on the cushion, they watch the breath, they straighten the back, and boom. You know, it's like being at that door, right? That experience of wonder or enchantment, you know? And you feel tension goes away, your pulse becomes rhythmical. You get that same sense of connection, peace, open possibilities that you might get going through a mountain valley, you know, if you were hiking, you know, or going and seeing a beautiful painting at the museum. It's this experience of something's happening, something's opening up, right? And it's beautiful. But, you know, you could come to sit the next time, and it doesn't happen. You sit on the cushion, you know, and your back hurts. And you think, ah, you know, what happened to my beautiful ecstasy? You know, my beautiful experience of openness. You know, my back hurts. I can't focus today. You know, I'm still stressed, you know, 1,000 thoughts in my head. This is not what I thought. And you could keep practicing, but if you're always thinking about the moment of enlightenment or the moment of magic, you know, I think you're going to misunderstand what Zen is all about. And eventually, you may feel very cheated by your practice, or you may feel very unhappy with yourself. You know, I myself practiced Zen with a kind of goal orientation for a long time. So when I got started with Zen, I was actually a rather unhappy person. And Zen did help me almost immediately. I had problems with depression and so on, and I started doing Zen faithfully, regularly. And those clouds lifted, and after a while they never came back. But I really did think of Zen practice in terms of the payoff. You know, like I was going to go to a retreat, a sesshin, and I was going to sit on the cushion, and boom, you know, the sky would open up and enlightenment would be in front of me and I would be utterly transformed. And this didn't happen. I would go to retreat after retreat after retreat. And I began to feel very disappointed in myself and disappointed in my practice. And eventually, I got over that. But it took me a long time. Maybe I can save you some time by suggesting that it would be good to think about Zen practice in a different way. You know, this is more like, Zen practice is like an art of consciousness. So I would suggest that you think about what we're doing as like a kind of practice with art, for art practice. Yeah? So, you know, if you're a painter, you know, you're not going to sit down one day and do déjeuner sur l'air, you know, beautiful painting of people having a lunch on the grass, you know, beautiful women, two men, you know. That took years and years of effort. And if you're thinking, I've got to paint a masterpiece, painting is going to be miserable for you, right? You say, I've got to paint a masterpiece. I've got to make a masterpiece. That's just the worst way to start. You know, if you're interested in painting, it's probably because something deep in your unconscious is saying, you know, you ought to paint. You you pick up a brush and you just feel like, wow, this is what I was born to do. You know, I love this, you know? And then you're just painting, right? And you get up every day and you paint, and some days it's there and some days it's not there. Yeah? This is like the life of the arts. Right? Every day it's like you get up and you paint and you see what presents itself. You know, today you're trying to do some oranges, yeah? And you mix the colors and you try it out and they're not quite right, the shape's not right, you know. You get up the next day and you have those oranges there and you paint them again, and then maybe, you know, you have to get some new oranges, or you eat them and you start painting apples, you know. But you do this every day, right? It's not about painting a masterpiece. It's about being true to your true self, see? If there's something about art you love, you just do it because you love it. And when you do it, whether you paint a masterpiece or not, you feel better. You feel happy. You know. I hope I'm making some sense. But people who follow like a path of the arts can have a good understanding of this. They know every time you sit down at the piano or every time you pick up your guitar, you're not going to sound like Segovia. It's not going to happen. And if that's your goal, you're going to be miserable. Right? But if you say, okay, the guitar is my true self, right? It's my true self. And when I play the guitar, I feel connected to the universe. You know, I feel connected to the universe even when I hit the wrong string, you know, even when I'm just not clicking today, you know. See, that's a way to... That's the way to go, I think. Yeah. Same thing with writing. You know, I'm not a real writer, but I do write all the time, and I write books that nobody reads, and things like that, like many people in the university. And I could sit down and think, I've got to write a masterpiece. You know, I've got to write something everybody's going to read and be in awe of. And that would make my life totally miserable. It's the process that is so wonderful, right? You sit down at the word processor and try to write something, nothing comes. You know, day two, not very good. Day three, eventually, you know, you sit down at the word processor and it's like the door opens and lightning strikes and the stuff comes out on the paper, and it's a great gift. You really don't control it. It just happens. It's like this gift. And the proper response, I think, is just to be grateful and say, I don't know how it came out on the page, but I'm really happy it happened. If this happens to you a few times, you realize that you're not really controlling any of this. You're just becoming a conduit, for this energy, right? You just make yourself like an electric wire, and the electricity is going to flow through the wire. And this is the life of the artist, of the writer, of the painter, and it's the life of the man or woman of Zen, right? You're making yourself a conduit for the universe, for its life energy. And you sit on the cushion, and it's not about the goal. It's about the process, the practice, see, the practice. And if you stop thinking about the goal and you begin to get close to the process, you know, goals don't matter anymore, because the wonder, the enchantment begins to happen just by being close to the process. You know, there are there are some wonderful painters who have not really been very happy with their art. And there are some very mediocre painters who have really understood the depth of their path, right? Their way. And I have to tell you, I would much rather be the mediocre artist who has the deep experience of the path, you know, the connection with the universe. That's what really I think the arts are all about. Naturally, we love the virtuoso performance, but that's not so important if the proper attitude isn't there. If you're starting Zen practice, or if you've just started Zen practice, I'm going to tell you the truth. Zen practice is going to require a serious effort on your part. In other words, you know, if you want to get somewhere with Zen practice, you have to practice regularly. That means often, like 4 times a week, 5 times a week. That would be perfect, right? A great writer, Ernest Hemingway, used to write every day. He made it his task to write. In fact, most writers I've studied in my life write a lot. You know, they write every day. And they don't write something good every day. They are servants of the process. They go to the typewriter, or they pick up their pen, and they just write. And a lot of it goes in the trash, but that's not the point. If you want to be a man of Zen or a woman of Zen, you have to put some time in, just as you would if you wanted to play the guitar. You know, you practice once a week, and, you know, you can just forget it, right? You want to play the guitar well, you have to sort of give yourself to the guitar. And so this commitment is essential. But if you're too goal-oriented, you won't be able to give yourself to your guitar, right? You won't be able to give yourself to the paint. You just have to say, whatever happens is okay. You know, please teach me. Please take me somewhere. Right? Take me somewhere. See, I think the artists, you know, the Marc Chagalls, the Georgia O'Keeffes, they didn't start out thinking, this is what I'm going to do, right? They just let the painting take them somewhere. And they were open enough to the discoveries that they could do something with it. They were open, you know. There was an anthropologist who just died day before yesterday. His name was Clifford Geertz. I don't know if you have ever taken an anthropology course. But Clifford Geertz was probably one of the greatest anthropologists in the second half of the 20th century. And he died a few days ago. He was 80 years old. He died of heart failure. And I can remember when I was a student in college, an undergraduate, reading an essay by him on religion. And it blew my mind. He was the smartest man I had ever read, I thought. You know, the smartest person I had ever read. I never read anybody smarter than Clifford Geertz. I thought he was the greatest thing you could imagine. I just thought, this guy is, who is this guy? And it was so exciting for me. He opened so many doors for me. Anyway, they had this little obituary in the newspaper, and they were talking about him. And as it turns out, he didn't start out to be an anthropologist. He was an English major. He was in the service. And then he came back, a little older student. He was an English major, and he finally went to graduate school, but he didn't know what he really wanted to study. And somebody said, why don't you study anthropology? He had never taken an anthropology course. Isn't that interesting? And he didn't one day say, I will be the greatest anthropologist of all time, right? He didn't say that. He just got interested in anthropology. It was like a little fire, you know, in dry grass. You know, it just smolders for a while and then boom. This was his path, right? And you could say it's amazing. You know, he wrote book after book after book. It was so amazing, his career. And how did he do it? And I think the secret's right there in the obituary. You know, he didn't set out to do any of this. He was just looking for wonder. He was just looking for enchantment. And he just kept following his path. And he was open enough to see new things when they presented themselves. And I think that's it. I think that's his secret. So, you know, if you want to do Zen, you really have to practice, just as you would playing an instrument or a painting or writing. And I have to tell you the truth that, you know, Zen practice is not something you can finish in a year or 2 years. And that's what this koan is really all about. The koan is saying, Deshan's completion of study is not like studying books. It's like following your path. It's like standing at the door, wondering what's on the other side, you know, that magical door. So great master Yuan Ming of Deshan said to the assembly, when you get to the ultimate end, you just find the Buddhas of all times have their mouths hung on the wall. There is still someone who laughs, ha ha. If you know this one, your task of study is finished. Now the truth is, if you practice Zen regularly and faithfully, open-heartedly, without expectation, probably within, say, a month to 6 months, you're going to begin to have these wonderful experiences where you sit on the cushion and you feel like you're in something. It's like all of a sudden you feel like you're in it. You're connecting with something. It's like, it's hard to describe, but you feel it. It's like you're in the flow, right? In the flow. And this won't happen every time. It might just happen once in 3 months initially. Might not happen for another month after that. You know, but you begin to have these experiences of connectedness, being in the flow. And then, you keep practicing, They will happen subtly, more and more, more and more. Usually, within, say, about 4 to 5 years, yes, that's right, 4 to 5 years, right? People begin to have little breakthroughs at Sesshin, little breakthroughs on the course. Sometimes it can be faster. Sometimes it can be, you know, but 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, somewhere in there, right? Begin to have breakthroughs. It's like you walk into that other room, and it's like being in a hallway in New Jersey and opening it up, and on the other side is the Grand Canyon. And this is kind of what happens, can happen sometimes. And these experiences start to happen after a certain number of years. And they can get deeper and deeper and deeper. And may not particularly feel deeper. One might be deep and the next one not so deep, and the next one deep. But this goes on and on for a number of years, right? Sooner or later, there's a very decisive experience that we talk about called Daikensho, Great Awakening. But you know, even after that, it's not over. The secret is, it's never over, right? Because you start practicing often with a goal in mind, right? A goal in mind. But after a while, you realize that goal doesn't matter. I mean, of course we're here because we want to wake up. But you know, every time you sit on the cushion, you're waking up, waking up, waking up. It's the process. It's the waking up all the time, waking up all the time. So it's the process. After a while, goal doesn't matter. It's just the beautiful process. I mean, I don't think Andre Segovia worried about being Segovia. He just loved the guitar. Right? And in fact, when Segovia started playing the guitar, nobody even thought the guitar was worth playing. Everybody was under the spell of, you know, European symphonic music. And the guitar was thought to be a folk instrument, right? And Segovia picked it up and said, this is a beauty, listen to this. And he raised the guitar out of obscurity, really, in from what I understand, and made it a major instrument, you know, after a year, after centuries of neglect. And so people like me buy, CDs of Segovia music. So he didn't do it because he wanted to be the great Segovia. He did it because it spoke to him, and he followed that. And it spoke to him on a deeper level. You know, sometimes you can sit on the cushion, and your back can hurt, your legs can hurt. You can be too hot or too cold. You can be sick or you can be healthy. You can be hungry, whatever. You can be sleepy, you can have too much sleep. But you know, you feel so alive. Even so, you feel like you're connecting to something. And so pain, these things don't really matter. You know, sometimes if you write, you feel like you're going to lose. I mean, I remember seeing a movie on Dashiell Hammett and Lillian Hellman. You might not know who they are, but Dashiell Hammett was a very well-regarded novelist in the 1920s in America, and he was living with a woman who was one of the 20th century's best American playwrights, a woman named Lillian Hellman. And Dashiell Hammett really helped her to develop as a writer, as a playwright, because she didn't have any confidence in herself, but she had a lot of confidence in him. So he sort of encouraged her, gave her the courage to sit down at the typewriter. This is in the old days when people had typewriters. I don't know if you know what those are, but they were like a word processor. Let me just put it down. But you didn't have to plug them in, right? And she, in this film, which was very well done, at one point she actually took her typewriter and threw it out the window, right? And anybody who's ever written understands what that's like, right? You know, it's just like, naturally she went out and got the typewriter again, right? They're made out of iron, so it's not like a word processor, right? You threw that out the window, that's the end, right? But she, you know, picked it up, it was probably 50 pounds, and brought it back in, put it back down, and started pounding away with a cigarette in her mouth. One of the, I'll wrap it up, but I don't get to watch movies very often, but my wife talked me into watching Million Dollar Baby, yeah? And I was very moved by that movie. I am not in favor of the fight game, let me say, because that really does kill people, right, or really injures them. But I thought that movie was interesting because the woman in there who got involved in fighting, you know, she was really like a Zen practitioner in a certain way, you know. This was what brought her to life, you know. And even though I think fighting is really a bad way to come to life, you know, really destructive. That was her way. Right, that was her path, and it wasn't about winning. It was about connecting with the universe. Right, that was how she connected with the universe, and that's why she loved it, and probably that's why she did well. Yeah. And at the end, you know, if you've, I don't want to, you've probably, everybody in the universe has seen the movie, you know. But she's injured and she's in her hospital bed and her life is shot, you know. But she did what she wanted to do, and she actually says that, you know, I think she says that. And Morgan Freeman, the old boxer who lost an eye, said, you know, I may have lost my eye, but I did what I wanted to do, see. I think people like that are living a true life. I really do. Please don't go into boxing, you know. And in fact, the beauty of Zen is you can't get hurt, I swear. You know, it may feel like your legs are getting hurt, but they're not, you know. And this is really good for you, and doesn't hurt you at all. And it's good for your blood pressure. And but even, you know, even if it does have a little bit of a price, you know, if you're following your true self, what we call in Zen your true nature, if you're listening to the voice of your true nature, you know, the price just doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. Because this is bigger than that. This is bigger than that. Yeah. So, if you're thinking of walking the path of Zen, and this is sort of what you're getting into, right? When does it end? When you answer your first koan? No. When you answer your 100th koan? No. When you have first kensho? No. When you answer the mu koan? No. When you have dai kensho? No. When does it doesn't end? Doesn't end. See? And that's because it's alive. See, that's because it's alive.